Hey y'all, how's it going? I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Libertarian foreign policy mostly. But you know, we talk about the cops and politics and junk too. It's pretty fun. You'll like it. Try it. You'll like it. All right. So, cool. All right. Man. So, well, I thought I was going to get to talk to Cade Crockford again tomorrow, but nope. She's been bumped to next week. And that's too bad. And Ned Parker. Why, he wrote this thing about the Shiite militias for Reuters. I wanted to talk with him about that, but, yeah. Nope. Can't do it. But the good news is that Phil Weiss is going to be on the show today. Good old Phil Weiss from the Mondo Weiss blog, where I learn things every single day. Are you like me? Do you learn things every single day at MondoWeiss.net? Yeah, me too. So, mostly, well, Mondo Weiss covers, hey, the war of ideas in the Middle East. So what's happening there, and then, but the Israel lobby here, too. And you know, Phil is more of an expert in the American side of the news here, so we're going to be discussing some of that with him today on the show. Yeah. And then, you know, I got a couple more invites out. I guess we'll see. I got quite a few more invites out. Next week on the show, Andrew Coburn is going to be on. So that's good. I had a special request. Somebody said, you know what you got to do? You got to interview Andrew Coburn about the Soviet Union. That's funny because there's not a Soviet Union. Ah, but that's okay. Because at one point in time, there was. And during one of those points of time, Andrew Coburn wrote a book about how the CIA was full of crap. Really, the neocons, Team B. And the boys were lying their asses off about Soviet military capabilities. And why? Money, power, influence. You know, the game. And so, you know what? We assess that we're pretty sure that the Soviets have an entire fleet of super secret, super silent submarines. And we can't find any anywhere. But the more we can't find, the more we're sure there are out there. Pay me. They reported. So anyway, apparently Andrew wrote a book about that back in the 1980s. About how, yeah, all these overestimates of Soviet military capabilities. And somebody wrote to me and says, you ought to interview him about that because he's got some very interesting tales to tell. Now, what I should have done is ran out and got the book, but nah. But I already know a little bit of that story, and I think Andrew can handle it. I already know. I've heard this story from Ray McGovern 100 times on this show. About Robert Gates and how the reason that the CIA had no idea that the Soviet Union was about to fall apart was because Robert Gates was in charge of pretending that it was going to last forever and might just, you know, expand to conquer all of the third world. And yeah. Well, that was his job, telling lies, you know. But so... missed the forest for the trees. Well, he was chasing super secret, super silent submarines that didn't exist around the seven seas, which can take a while and a lot of attention. So, you understand the position that he put himself in. Yeah. Right. Anyway, so that'd be fun. Catch up with him. Yeah. In other news, tonight... at liberty.me, I will be once again hosting Jacob Hornberger for another episode of The Future of Freedom. The Future of Freedom. And that's our show. And I interview him about what he thinks about things. I guess we'll probably talk about politics and talk about things. Talk about what he wrote. So that'd be fun. Good old Jacob Hornberger. That's liberty.me tonight at 8 Eastern time. If you want to watch the show, check it out there. Okay, cool. And then a little bit more news. I think it's all right to go ahead and say this. Why the hell not, man? So this morning, had a conference call with Tom Woods and the literary agent. And he seems to think that he can sell this book to somebody. We got to put together a really good proposal, though, for it. But then, he seems into it. Looks like a go. It's going to take a long time, but it'll get done. Apparently, maybe. So I got a lot of work to do. I'm getting that proposal ready, but shouldn't be a problem, man. I'm just going to knock that thing out. Brew me up a pot or two of coffee, and how long could it possibly take to write a proposal? Anyway, so that's my plan, Stan. We'll see what happens with that. But, and you all know what the book's going to be. It's just what I say here every day. In the War on Terrorism, kind of a thing. Tonight, Eye on the Empire. Tonight, it's the future of freedom. Catching up on the show. That's funny. Yeah, I'm really not that good at broadcasting, Kit. I'm just a guy in a room with a mic, that's all. I know in y'all's life, I'm this voice that goes with you places and all this stuff, but I'm just a guy in a room. I don't know what the hell I'm doing. I'm right about everything, but I don't know what the hell I'm doing. By the way, if I owe you an email, sorry, I probably will catch up soon at some point and email you back. But that is, certainly, I don't know, a confession I gotta make. I owe many people emails. What can I say? I am just buried in them. Sucks. You know what I need is a lot of money and a secretary. So then I could be like, Susie, did you answer those emails for me? Thanks. Or whatever her name would be, But anyway, no money, no secretary. Backlog of desperate communications. People dying to hear back from me. Gotta wait. All right. So anyway, mercifully, the segment's almost over. Stop, take a break, we'll regroup here a little bit, start the show over again in 5 minutes from now, and see if we can't, crank it up a little bit here. See what happens. I don't want to talk about the debate. I guess here's all I have to say about the debate. What a bunch of maroons, right? Whole thing was completely stupid. And all I have to say about Rand was he was still him the whole time. He didn't break out from his previous rut whatsoever. So what else is there to say? And same old him. Even at the end where he's like, I want government so small, you thought he was going to just outright rip off the phrase from Norquist. Looked like he almost was going to. I want to be so small that you can barely see it. Meh. Still, just no real emphasis on liberty, every single one of them said the same thing. Jeb Bush is like, yeah, of course regulate fantasy football, but I don't know if it should be on the federal level. I mean, my gut instinct is, oh no, the federal government should be small. Right, Rand Paul? And they all agree, yeah, we all believe in small government. And he didn't distinguish himself from that at all. If Ron had been there, think of how different that debate would have been. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Yeah, so I watched pretty much the whole damn thing last night, and I barely remember any of it. It's just a bunch of blah, blah, blah from a bunch of Republicans. I guess Huckabee distinguished himself as more socialist than the rest when it came to no means testing, even for millionaires and billionaires on Social Security and that kind of thing, and his big government projects to abolish disease for all time. This is conservatism. Let's see. I don't know. I can't think of another thing to say other than, oh, Jeb Bush was pathetic and horrible, and it's so much fun to watch what a hard time he's having. That's the redeeming quality of the whole thing, is looking at Jeb Bush squirm up there. I mean, here's a guy who all of power said to him, here's the presidency, handed to him on a silver platter. All you got to do is stand there, dumbass, and it's yours. And he's ruining it. He can't even just walk into the damn presidency without stumbling and falling down. And he can blame it on Trump all he wants, but that's not what it is. You know what it is? He has none of the charisma of George W. Bush. Now, personally, I hate George W. Bush. Absolutely hate him. Always have hated him. But I can see why some people like him. I can see why some people say, yeah, I know he's a Bush and he's a zillionaire and he's part of that whole thing. But, you know, at least he knows people like us. He's had a beer with people who make less than $1 million a year before. You think Jeb ever has? I think Jeb is, you know, as comfortable around. As, in fact, as George W. Bush put it, I think. Oh, no, I'm stealing this from the movie W, but it's probably a direct quote where he says, hey, I own a baseball team, so I'm around the janitors and the soda fountain and hot dog vendor guys all the time, and I talk to them all the time, so I know what real people think and that kind of thing. Well, there's like a kernel of truth in that, right? Like he did pseudo grow up in West Texas around people who were, you know, at least upper middle class, but not zillionaires. He didn't grow up in Kennebunkport, Maine. I don't know what the hell Jeb's childhood was like. But W had that beer test quality. People at least believed that they could have a beer with him and talk about sports and whatever, whatever. But Jeb is just such a stiff, freaking ridiculous character. I don't know. He's just, there's nothing for anybody to like about him. And it's fun to me to actually see the discussion of all of this. You know, in the media and on Twitter, it's the same as it ever was. But that's what's notable, is it still isn't changing. That people actually believe in democracy. They actually think, and I mean that with a very little d, very broadly defined term for all you, you know, technicalitarians out there. Oh, it's a limited republic. No, it's not. It's an unlimited world empire. Pay attention. People believe that it's up to them. People believe it's a democracy in the sense that, well, I don't, you know, people really don't like Jeb, so maybe it'll be Rubio instead. Maybe they'll decide they like him or whatever like that. No, that's not how this works. And yes, it's true that Rubio is an establishment guy and is trying very hard to be. but he's not really electable because the Republican Party is basically the solid Protestant South. And they're just not going to turn out for a guy with a vowel at the end of his name. They're not, because they're bigots. Or, you know, they're fearful of papists, man. They are. I think it's silly, but it is what it is. And Jeb, actually, that's working against Jeb, too, is he's a converted Catholic. That probably doesn't hurt him as bad. His last name is still Bush. He comes from Episcopalian stock, so I don't know. Maybe that's too elitist, too, but. See, Junior called himself a Methodist, right? Anyway, it ain't gonna be Rubio. There's where democracy works. It can be impossible to get people to support this guy or that. But that still doesn't mean it's up to them to choose. Although, you know, within limits, obviously. Jeb could completely just continue to fail, but still looks to me like he's going to have enough money behind him. At status quo campaigning levels or whatever, he's going to have enough zillionaire support to stay in the race till it still comes down to him versus Trump. There's nobody else in there that's going to last as long as those two are. Still going to come down to those two. And at this point, I think it's possible that Trump might beat him, but I don't know, man. But, you know, Carson has this bump right now. People go, well, what about Carson? He's got this bump right now. Yeah, but he's not going to be able to sustain it, and the millionaires and the billionaires are not going to rally behind him because they can't count on him because he's too weird for them. And so he can have his popularity bump, like Newt Gingrich had a popularity bump. Herman Cain had his popularity bump. Did that mean that they even at those during those bumps became even 1% more likely to actually carry it through to the end and get the nomination? No. Never did. And so I think you could probably dismiss Carson. You know, what he has going for him is that he's not a politician. He's not a governor or a senator. And people don't want governors or senators. But comes down to it, I know I'm repeating myself here. I still give it 51-49 odds that Jeb will get the nomination. As opposed to Trump. Because, you know, the Republican Party leadership in the various states and at the national level, you know, they've got a business relationship that they got to maintain here. And it is possible. In fact, it would take somebody like a Trump who has his own money and who can create a groundswell of people to come in and just override the process, get new voters in there. Although I think he'll be burnt out by then. Takes too long to run these campaigns. People get sick of him by then. I don't know. Maybe not. But that's what it would take, right? Think about if, instead of Trump, if Ron Paul all of a sudden had discovered that his long-lost uncle had left him $1 billion and he could spend all of that on the campaign. Had that much, you know, power to use, or, you know, ability to run on his own merit, stay in that long. I don't know. Anyway. But otherwise, unless it's an absolute outlier, then the centrist rhino candidate wins, because that's who has the only chance of beating the centrist candidate on the other side. On the other hand, this time 2007... everybody on TV was agreed that nobody can stop Hillary. Now, of course, she's going to totally win. Although, see, I don't think the analogy holds. She had Edwards and Obama were just as acceptable to the establishment. Obama had already, at that point, had already locked up half of the leadership of the Democratic Party who were sick of the Clintons. But there, Bernie Sanders would have to have $1 billion like Trump to create that much of a groundswell on the right to put him in there. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. That's funny. In the chat room, JDA saying, yeah, man, no, I'm totally buying the conspiracy theory that Donald Trump is just a ringer for Hillary anyway, because who would really want the job of having to kiss Netanyahu's ass all day every day? He couldn't really want that for his life. No way. So, it's obviously all a put on, and I think he makes a compelling argument. Remember when Obama was caught on an open mic with Sarkozy from France, and Sarkozy's going, oh my God, I hate Benjamin Netanyahu so much. And Obama goes, oh my God, I gotta talk to him every day. You think you got it bad. No, that was what it was. You think you got it bad. I gotta deal with him every day. Can you imagine? Not me. Not me. All right. So, the story told in the top headlines on antiwar.com today is really something else. Pentagon, we're in combat in Iraq. Look, everyone, Delta Force hero, hostage rescue, American flag. Oh, by the way, yeah, we're going ahead and put the ground troops in now. Well, before we were saying that special forces in combat doesn't count as combat. Now we're going to go ahead and say, okay, you're right, it does. And therefore, loophole open, bring in the infantry. You got to have force protection for your forces, right? And you got to have air power in order to provide force protection for your force protection. And now you're going to need force protection for your air power, dummy. And who's going to protect those forces, huh? Meanwhile, as I told you yesterday, the Iraqis are saying, we didn't ask for this. Aw, man. So what's going on here? Obviously, they're just trying to preempt the Russians. This is so stupid. And I'm sorry, because I know I'm just beating a dead horse for people who've been listening to this show, but people listen to this show from 2004 on. 2003, even, probably. Definitely by 2004, knew that America's fighting for the Iranian-Russian axis here. We're fighting not just for the Shia, because the Shia included Muqtada al-Sadr, who was an Arab nationalist who wanted an alliance with the Sunnis against Iran and the United States and to save Iraqi sovereignty and have a compromised government. No, America chose the most Iranian-allied Shia factions, the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawah Party, who'd been living in exile in Iran for 30 years at that point, ever since Jimmy Carter hired Saddam to invade Iran for him after the revolution, which overthrew America's sock puppet fascist tortured dictator, the Shah Reza Pahlavi. So, when America put them in power in Baghdad, well, they fought a 5-6 year civil war for them to kick all the Sunnis out of Baghdad and give them no reason to compromise with the Sunnis whatsoever and to create an Iraqi Shiistan. And it was told all along that the Dawah Party and they said all along, the Dawah Party and the Supreme Islamic Council said all along, yeah, we want strong federalism, meaning we want to let Sunnistan go. We don't care who rules Sunnistan, just as long as they don't rule us. We want to break Iraq in three, the Biden plan. That was what the Iranian factions wanted. It's a fool's errand to try to rule Mosul, Ramadi, Fallujah. You know, no point in bleeding yourself to death on that stone. Just cut them loose. Once you got America to fight the civil war and take Baghdad for you, now out. The whole thing was obvious. The whole war long, it was obvious. So America fought for its adversaries in the region.
against its allies, the Sunnis and their Mujahideen sock puppet types. And now, here they are going, oh no, the Russians are moving in on our action in Iraqi Shiistan. Come on, that's not our action in Iraqi Shiistan. That's why two-thirds to three-quarters of the Iraqi Shia armed force against the Islamic State is out of the question from being directly backed, because they're the Shiite militias. We'll only back the Iraqi army, which hardly exists anymore at all. It's the Shiite militias who are doing all the fighting. And they're backed by the Iranians. They're run on the ground by the Iranian special forces. But they won't admit, so now they're just... They want to fight. The Pentagon right now is acting like the fight over Shiistan, and it's 2005. Yeah, you know what we're going to do? As we're fighting for the most Iranian-backed factions among the Shia, we're going to sit here and limit Iranian influence in Iraq somehow, guys. Watch us. And they're going to replay that same damn thing again after they've already been bested at it before. We're in combat in Iraq. Air power and special forces and soon enough infantry and marines. And the Iraqi Shia government is saying, we didn't even ask you. We don't want you. We got the Russians. We prefer them. And then you have... Turkey is bombing the U.S.-backed Syrian Kurds who are fighting the Islamic State, in which the Americans are only tentatively backing anyway. But then you have, I like this, Iran accepts invite, will attend Syria talks. It does look like it's possible that the Americans are backing down from the Assad must go first ultimatum. And, you know, the Russians have said that they're open to easing him out as long as they can preserve the government in Damascus. So, looks like, and the Saudis were meeting with the Russians the other day. I don't know whether they actually got anywhere or not. You gotta assume that the talks were actually, you know, business, and not just pleasantries, though. But here in Iran, has been invited. The Americans have dropped their opposition to Iran attending the talks. So, that's important. I don't know if the Syrians, if anybody from any side in Syria is there, but really there's nobody to represent the Mujahideen side. What, you're going to bring a bunch of suicide bombers to Switzerland to negotiate or something like that? The Saudis will have to negotiate on their behalf. And their role in this shall be to stop backing the jihadists and let their movement dry up. But anyway,
I was going to make a joke, but I forgot about how back in the late 90s and early 2000s when I was a New World Order conspiracy type, the whole game, of course, was, you know, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. Now that the Cold War is over and America's become a lot more like the Soviet Union and the USSR has become, or the former USSR, has become a lot more like America, now we merge together into the one big white army of the North, NATO, against Islamic South Asia and the new war on terrorism. That's what's obviously going to happen here, I thought, and then that's, of course, not at all what happened. And Dick Cheney and George Bush turned on Putin, no matter what he did for them, and picked a fight with Russia and have been picking a fight with Russia and doubling down and tripling down on the expansion of NATO. And yet, here we are, with the Russian intel chief saying ISIS threatens Central Asia, which is now undoubtedly true, as NATO may send more troops to Russian border. So instead of my New World Order conspiracy theory, even 15 years later, being accurate, that America would join with Russia, God forbid, bring them into NATO even worse, in order to fight the giant war on terrorism, right now, in this timeline, in this dimension we're suffering through here, America is on the side of Al-Qaeda in the war on terrorism, in the war of terrorism against the Russians. Ain't that fun? No, wait. That's problematic.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime future freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security.
the Second Amendment and the right to keep and bear arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the right to keep and bear arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. The heroic Philip Weiss is going to be joining us here in a while, if you'll hang around. I think you might like it. All right, man. So, listen, a lot of people have asked me about this. A lot, meaning a few. Do you have a spot, a single place where you explained Benghazi? Did you write about it? Did you talk about it? Can you show me one place where I can learn the story of the Benghazi thing? All right, so. This is the story, then, I guess, of one fake scandal and two very real ones. Of course, the fake one is the one that's gotten all the attention. And that is the scandal based around the question of whether or not the State Department had provided enough security to protect this makeshift American consulate in the town of Benghazi in eastern Libya, where the ambassador, Christopher Stevens, the few security guards he did have, or a couple of the security guards he did have, and a couple other State Department employees were killed. I guess it was a total of four men were killed, right? Anyway, and then there was an attack on the CIA safe house an hour or so later, this and that. So the question, the fake part of the scandal, to me, is the question of whether there was enough security there, whether the Secretary of State or the people under her at the State Department were paying enough attention to the security situation there, and whether they were doing enough to make sure that there was enough security that the ambassador wouldn't get killed. The Republicans have decided that they can make some money and try to use this as a political issue to run against the Democrats and say that they're not very good at being the government or whatever, right? And then the second question is about the stand-down order. And you know what? This part I haven't really looked into enough, but it seems like the debunking of this is kind of a red herring. And maybe this is the bulk of the accusation. I don't know. But there was a question whether the guys at the CIA safe house should immediately rush to the embassy or whether they should wait like 10 minutes or whatever it was to get a hold of their local, bribed militia backup to come with them. And once they got that taken care of, they headed out. It wasn't a stand-down thing. It was a, wait, I'm calling, Jihadi John to come over here and help us, and we're going to go and save the day there, kind of thing. So that's not a stand-down order. But then again, I think that's kind of a debunking of a red herring. The other question was, well, what about CIA and or military assets in Tripoli? And how long would it have taken them to get there? And what about the ones based in Italy? And what were the orders and whatever? And I don't know all the details of those. But I do think that it's probably a red herring argument because this isn't the movies. And the military doesn't just go flying in jet bombers when they don't know what the hell the bomber, you know, exactly what's going on or who's doing what. That's the kind of thing they plan for a week and then go. I know they call themselves heroes all day. Look at us, we're heroes. And that makes you think of Hollywood, but it isn't really like that, I think, in real life. But anyway, who cares about that? Because even if that's somewhat true, best still, what it really reveals is just how corrupt the Republicans are, that is all they will focus on instead of the two real big scandals. And the two real big scandals. Oh, man, am I off the air right now? What the hell? Oh, crap. All right, well. All right, if anybody can hear me, tell me. I guess not. Let me try to call Ian. What a great place to get interrupted.
I wonder how long I've been off the air. I always like talking to nobody for no good reason at all. How about, yeah, I already played that before. I'll play this.
The point, very simple, was this. We knew the Soviets were already conducting operations in Afghanistan. We knew there was opposition in Afghanistan to the progressive effort which was being made by the Soviets to take over.
You guys can hear me now? Huh? Hey. Am I on or what? Yeah, am I on the air or not? I can hear you. I can hear you. You can't hear me? It's your side. I don't know if anybody can hear me or not. Hey, man. So am I on the air? Check, check, check. They're playing an old show. Hey, Ian. Check, check, check. Okay. It was your end that you couldn't hear me, or it was your end that dropped me? Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't care. No problem. Thanks. All right, guys. Yeah, I'm back. Little technical difficulty at LRN. No big deal. All right. So anyway, I guess I don't know how much of what I said you guys missed, but I ain't going back over it. Check the archives later if you want. Right now, I'm at the part where no matter if there's any truth to the scandals that the Republicans make a big deal of when it comes to Benghazi, the lack of security or the delayed response in saving the day like they expect should happen in a situation like that. Even if there's anything to either of those scandals, they still pale in comparison to the real ones. And, they're just kind of the light that casts the shadow that shows you the, what the Republicans omit and what they refuse to focus on. The two very, very real Benghazi scandals. The first one is that Hillary and Barack lied that there was an impending genocide that had to be stopped. It's just not true. I saw that piece of crap Bill Maher in an argument with that piece of crap Andrew Sullivan saying, oh, a bunch of people were about to die. Shut up. You have no idea what you're talking about, you stupid idiot. I hate that guy, Bill Maher. Oh, I heard Bill Maher's a libertarian. Oh, yeah? Did you ever hear a libertarian say that? Or you heard a liberal call him that? Because last I heard, he's just Hillary Clinton on every single issue. And that's not libertarian, thanks. Seriously, I hate that guy more than Rand Paul. Anyway, point is, that is such a damn lie. Gaddafi did not say that he was going to kill every man, woman, and child in Benghazi. What he said he was going to do was he was going to send his goons to kill the rebels who were trying to overthrow him. Right? Just like he'd done in all the cities he'd taken already. You know, where the rebels had made advances and he took those towns back. They didn't systematically massacre all the people. What comic book crap is this? I mean, at least in the case of Bosnia, Kosovo, Albania, this and that, you have plausible explanations for cleansing going on. But there's no reason to even believe that Gaddafi would think for a minute that it would be necessary or desirable at all to kill everyone in Benghazi. Like there's some alien force. It was just another part of his country that he had to keep down under his dictatorship, that's all. And compared to the number of casualties in the war to prevent the pretended genocide that was never going to happen, and, well, just stop there, far more than even what they claimed was going to happen. Well, no, I guess they were claiming 100,000. But say 20,000 would have actually died, which it probably would have been much less than that. But even say 20, we had that many killed in the war to prevent it. And then you've had the state of Libya no longer exists. Libya now is just a battleground of warring militias, two different official competing governments. Hey, I can hear you, Ian. I don't know if you can hear me, dude, but I can hear you.
And I don't know if the people can hear you or not. But anyway, yeah, giant, big, fake, impending genocide was never going to happen. Debunked by the CIA and the DIA at the time. And you can check Kelly Riddell in the Washington Times about the narrative of Benghazi genocide rejected. And there are a couple articles at the Washington Times with similar titles, but trust me, there's one that's about how the impending pseudo-genocide of the spring of 2011 was not going to happen. That the military and the CIA told Obama there's not about to be a genocide of 100,000 men, women, and children. And they did it anyway. They lied and pretended that that was their casus belli, and they did it anyway. And then the second real Benghazi scandal is the gun running operation. And really, this goes back to the whole war itself. The Libya war scandal, which is that the Libya war was fought on behalf of the Mujahideen. The Libya war was fought on behalf of the Libyan veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq and their buddies. And that was known all along, and they did it anyway. Again, you got to read the four-part series. I beseech you, read the four-part series by Jeffrey something, I forget, and Kelly Riddell at the Washington Times. I interviewed her about it. And you got to read the four-part series about how they could have had a peace deal and all of this, and how they knew it was the Al-Qaeda. And they warned Hillary as such and warned Obama as such. They did it anyway. So then the scandal is, why was Christopher Stevens stationed in the middle of a hornet's nest of Al-Qaeda fighters? And it's because he was on their side, running them and their guns off to the next Mujahideen war in Syria. And the red line and the rat line, or the rat line and the red line by Seymour Hersh, is the best write-up of this. But Judge Napolitano's had a couple of great ones based on Judicial Watch documents, etc. And there's just no question about this history. America fought the whole war for Al-Qaeda. They're the ones who killed Stevens, because he was working with them. He was guilty of treason, surprised that they snapped back. Not just blowback, but backdraft right in his face. Oh, and I'm already overtime in the goddamn break. I didn't hear that music going out, did you guys? Am I on? I don't hear the news. I don't hear nothing. Guess I'll play this.
The future, Winston. Imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
He says, taste the soup. He says, there's something wrong with the soup. Is the soup too hot? He says, will you taste the soup? It's wrong. Is the soup too cold? Will you just taste the soup? All right, I'll taste the soup. Where's the spoon? Aha! Aha!
In international waters in the Gulf of Tonkin, destroyers of the United States Navy are assigned routine patrols from time to time. Sunday, August the 2nd, 1964, the destroyer Maddox was on such a patrol. Shortly after noon, the calm of the day is broken as general quarters sound. In a deliberate and unprovoked action, three North Vietnam PT boats unleash a torpedo attack against the Maddox.
The destroyer was carrying out a mission of patrol in those waters, in international waters. When it was attacked, it...
In the need to develop a capacity to know what potential enemies are doing, the United States government has perfected a technological capability that enables us to monitor the messages that go through the air. Now, that is necessary and important to the United States as we look abroad at enemies or potential enemies. We must know. At the same time, that capability at any time could be turned around on the American people. And no American would have any privacy left, such as the capability to monitor everything, telephone conversations, telegrams, it doesn't matter. There would be no place to hide.
I've ordered military action in seven countries. I have ordered tens of thousands of young Americans into combat.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, Al Scott here. On average, how much do you think these interviews are worth to you? Of course, I've never charged for my archives in a dozen years of doing this, and I'm not about to start. But at patreon.com/ScottHortonShow, you can name your own price to help support and make sure there's still new interviews to give away. So what do you think? 2 bits? A buck and a half? There are usually about 80 interviews per month, I guess, so take that into account. You can also cap the amount you'd be willing to spend in case things get out of hand around here. That's patreon.com/ScottHortonShow. And thanks, y'all.
All right, y'all. Welcome back. I hope you can hear me. I've got some technical difficulties with Liberty Radio Network, but I assume that I'm on. Hey, there you go. Chat room says they can hear me, so that's good news. All right. This is going to be a little clunky with the breaks and everything, but they always are, kind of, ain't they, everybody? All right. So this is my show, the Scott Horton Show. That is a absolutely unacceptable rendition of what you need to know about Benghazi. And not only because of the technical problem, so I'll just have to do that again at some other point. You're one-stop shopping for the two bogus and two very real Benghazi scandals. Yeah, anyway. So, you know, I found that footnote that I told you guys about that I never found the footnote for you before, but I do have it here, and so now I'm going to tell you what it is. I don't know if this is right. This is the same Robert Gates who's horrible and evil and wrong about many, many horrible things, including, like I mentioned earlier, was in charge of not noticing that the USSR was falling apart in 1988 through 1991. So, anyway, at least he was good on Libya, but Hillary and Obama overruled him. But not that he resigned over it. He went ahead and murdered the Libyans, as he was told. So. Anyway, so here's Robert Gates complaining about Obama's Libya policy. He says, this is in military.com. Is that the original source for this, or this is some other thing? I think it's at military.com. Richard Sisk, S-I-S-K, October 22nd, 2015. Putin will pull back in Syria if the U.S. shows resolve to resist, says Gates. Shut up, stupid jerk. Anyway, so here's what he says that I think is important for the point of the thing that I'm trying to get to here. Gates faulted the Obama administration for failing thus far to communicate to Moscow clearly defined limits to its involvement in Syria, while apparently adopting a strategy of waiting for Russia to become bogged down in the quagmire of the Mideast. And then he goes on to change the subject and miss the point. Now, so, here's the thing about it, is, I guess he knows what he's talking about. Is it just apparent? You know what? This is his testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee. So I guess what I got to do is I got to find the soundbite myself. Because I don't think they provide the direct quote for the bogged down part. Let me see. I don't think they do. I mean, I already read through the damn thing once. But yeah, man, so I'll have to find this at C-SPAN. Robert Gates on October 22nd, Armed Services Committee. Not that I'll be able to queue it up now, but I better get it open here. So I'm sorry, man. I'm not really explaining what I'm talking about here and why it's important. Here's why it's important. The National Security Advisor
for Jimmy Carter back in the 1970s was a guy named Zbigniew Brzezinski, David Rockefeller's man, replaced Nelson Rockefeller's man, Henry Kissinger, as National Security Advisor. That's kind of how these things work. Anyway, so there's a myth that he perpetuates because it makes him seem smart. Eric Margulies says, I don't think so. But in fact, my wife, the investigative journalist, she says she can confirm that this is a fact. That the CIA began support for Mujahideen, the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and working with the Saudis and the Pakistanis on it before the Soviets invaded. And the reason that they did so, at least they claim after the fact, was in order to provoke the Russians into invading Afghanistan. And then we could bog them down. John Mueller points out whether this was really the plan or not is almost besides the point because the lesson is the same. But John Mueller points out in his book Overblown that containment protected Soviet power. Whether the Pentagon knew that or not, whether the Hawks knew that or not, containment helped the Soviets survive. And once the Americans lost in Vietnam and were humiliated, and Ford, and really, you know, the whole detente attitude of Kissinger at the end of the Nixon years and the beginning of the Ford years and into Carter was very much, you know, forget rollback and forget even containment, and kind of got out of the Russians' way. And they expanded and killed themselves. They expanded their many debts and obligations, including in Africa, in Latin America, and in Afghanistan, and they just couldn't afford it. I mean, hell, like, I don't know how they even lasted as long as they did with a communist economy. What are you, stupid? But so that was really the straw that broke the camel's back. So it's very much in the interests of the Americans when they tell the story now to say, oh, yeah, we tricked them. We deliberately got them to expand and overexpand to their ultimate detriment. So my idea was, and I should have thought of this before, I guess, was once I saw, oh, wait a minute, I'm skipping a part of the story. Another part of the story is the Mujahideen thought, let's do the same thing to the Americans. And bin Laden's mentor, Abdul Azzam, told Eric Margulies to his face, after we're done with the Soviets, you're next, Yankee imperialist pig. And what bin Laden wanted to do, and what he said he wanted to do all along, was get the Americans mad enough that they would invade Afghanistan. They could bog us down and bleed us to bankruptcy, destroy the empire, and force it out of the entire Middle East the same way they did to the Soviet Union. All you got to do is believe in Allah and wage your AK-47 courageously, and that's how you win. CIA help or not, wink, wink, was bin Laden's doctrine. Apply to the United States of America. Give them their own Vietnam. Again, Vietnam, again, obviously being shorthand for horrible, terrible, bloody, no-win quagmire that costs $1 trillion and destroys, you know, millions of lives there and here and disrupts society back home and everything else. Everything horrible that comes with a war in Vietnam. Poison gas. Rotting corpses. So here we are giving ourselves our own Vietnam again in Afghanistan 14 years on. And then, but so then I thought, wow, I wonder if it's possible that these idiots learn their own lesson that they've shown that they haven't learned, in the case of our war in Afghanistan. But maybe they have learned it and maybe they are applying it to the Russians in Syria. And maybe that is why Obama has done this half-ass, bleed both sides, support the Mujahideen war in Syria this whole time. It's the perfect carbon copy of America's Afghan policy. Make things so bad for Russia's ally in the capital city that they send in the troops and bleed the empire to bankruptcy. Get them bogged down fighting a bunch of suicide bomber jihadists. And, you know, back the jihadists enough to lure them in.
The only problem is there are a lot of different competing factions in American power, so we see all this talk about putting American soldiers on the ground in order to make them targets of the Russians. These people, they're trying to get American soldiers bombed by Russian planes in the sky. It's nuts. But anyway, if they would just go back to the Afghanistan in the 80s model and keep working with the Saudis to keep and other allies like Israel and Turkey and Qatar to keep bankrolling the Mujahideen, they could keep the Russians bogged down. It's the same thing as Reagan's State Department cut a deal with the Saudis to overproduce, and quote-unquote, and drop the price of oil real low. We have that, you know, in the market anyway, but the Saudis aren't doing much to cut back on production in order to boost the price. That very well could be part of the same conspiracy. In fact, Kerry was asked about that and gave some coy answer, which may or may not have been alluding to the truth, that was part of our deal with the Saudis, is this is how we hurt the Russians the most. We drop the price of their major export oil down to the floor, and then we drag them into a no-win war. Regime change against the USSR wasn't enough. They want regime change against Putin and the Kremlin right now. Carl Gershman of the National Endowment for Democracy said so himself. Oh, now I'm over time. I wasn't watching the clock and the music ain't playing. So here I'll stop talking. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to MPVEngineering.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back. Thanks, chat room guys, for helping out with the production today. Appreciate it. Coming up here in just a few minutes, we'll have Phil Weiss on and talk about the Israel lobby and things. Man, Jeb Bush is humiliating himself on Fox News right now. I'm only, you know, sort of kind of reading the captions. Got it on mute. But just looking at him, his face is, oh, nuh-uh. Protest. When? He's such a crybaby. He's such a loser, Jeb Bush. He's so fun to watch. She's asking him little things, and he's like forcing this fake smile. Please like me. Why don't you like me? lots of fun. And, you know, I'm sorry to talk about the thing again, the damn debate, but... So the part where he took on Rubio about not showing up to vote enough, like that's the weakest argument in the world. So first of all, him and his people, I mean, really, who gives a crap, right? That's exactly what I want as my senators, to never go to work. You kidding me? Please stop working. But anyway, so he wants to use that as a line of attack. Oh, you're being irresponsible. You're running for president as you're still a senator. And... anyway, the whole thing just falls completely flat. And Rubio says, oh, come on. You're only saying that because somebody convinced you that if you attack me, it might help you. And the whole place breaks out laughing. And the whole thing couldn't be more transparent and pathetic. And Jeb is just crushed. He's completely weak. And then proving just what a setup the whole thing was. And I read a thing that said that everybody knew... all the rumors all throughout Florida politics for days have been, oh, Jeb is going to attack Rubio for not voting enough in the Senate. Like, everybody knew that this was going to happen. That's the best Jeb has. And then with a bunch of warning. And then just proving how true that was, right after Jeb completely failed in his attack and got it completely stuffed right back down his throat, his team tweeted out short clips of Jeb's victory. Oh, look at Jeb.
putting the irresponsible Rubio in his place. So no one at the Jeb campaign even said, ooh, that didn't go well as we had planned. We better not go ahead with the soundbite. They went ahead with it anyway. As though it was Jeb's great victory. Look at Jeb take on the irresponsible Rubio, and they put him out getting his clock cleaned. Here's a short clip of the entire audience laughing in Jeb's face. And I know it's stupid. I know it's stupid. I'm sorry. But it's entertaining to me. Because, see, I hate Jeb Bush. And I think that if he's the president of America, he's going to be a really, really horrible president. So, therefore, and because I'm a bad person, I am happy that he is unhappy. His frustration is my joy. Well, I'm Jeb Bush. How come nobody likes me? Boo-hoo. Makes me smile. And so that's why. I know it's not substantive, but it's not just politics as gossip and theater. It's a real hatred and a real enjoyment of his pain and suffering. See? His humiliation. Don't anybody misquote me to the National Police State or anything. I'm not threatening anybody. I'm just saying I like it when the man is unhappy. That's all. I like it when people make fun of him and it's obvious that it hurts his feelings. Jeb Bush. Oh, yeah? Well, if you guys want to be jerks, I got a lot of better things I could be doing right now than running for president. Yeah, really? Go and do those things, you crybaby little bitch. Oh, yeah? Well, screw you guys. I'm going home. Jeb Bush. What a pathetic loser. How can you have the entire presidency just being handed to you and then you drop it? Ha! What a clown. What a pathetic disgrace. All right. Anyway, sorry. I didn't mean to get distracted. So Fox News put out this thing that wasn't true. I know you guys are shocked. You're saying to me, come on, Scott Horton, enough of your propaganda. But no, really. Effort to sanitize equipment missing at Iranian military site during nuke inspection. First of all, this took you 3 weeks, 4 weeks to put together? And then check out the dishonesty. Okay, we're talking about Iran. We're talking about the inspections of their nuclear facilities and their other facilities. In this case, a suspected nuclear site, the military base Parchin. But here is what Fox News is trying to claim. When the IAEA went out and the alleged equipment wasn't there, that's proof that the Iranians cleaned it all up and sanitized it. They pretend to put a question mark in the title, but that's their point. Well, if it's not there, where is it? They must have moved it. They, I bet they moved it to Syria with all Saddam's weapons of mass destruction. Right, everybody? And the premise for their argument, I swear, is so pathetic and stupid. But really, not just on TV, but in writing. The premise for their argument is the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, had previously confirmed that Parchin contained a so-called containment vessel, a special chamber for testing nuclear equipment, including triggers to detonate a warhead. Yet Fox is told, as though this hasn't been public knowledge for weeks, all over the world for weeks, Fox is told that when the IAEA toured the site for its upcoming report, the containment facility and equipment were gone, making it that much harder to test for radioactive residue. The source was not authorized to speak on the record. The source is Google.com, you dumb ass. The source is Yukiya Amano, the head of the IAEA, who gave a press conference that day and said, yeah, we went to Parchin and we looked and there's nothing in there. Fox News has learned, huh? Stupid. And where's the evidence that the IAEA had, quote, previously confirmed that Parchin contained a so-called containment vessel? Nowhere to be found. No source cited. No sources said. No nothing. Now, you would think that if the IAEA had said that, you'd be able to prove it. That the sentence would end or would include in it in their report of, say, I don't know, fall 2011 or something. But all they said in their report of 2011 was, this is alleged, and we want to find out if it's true. That's not confirmation. So you see how it works. First, they lie to you and say that somehow it's a known fact that this thing existed. And then, assuming that you're foolish enough to be deceived by that, they go on to say, and then they must have gotten rid of it because it's not there anymore. When in fact, there's no reason to believe it ever existed. And I'll send you right over to SIPRI.org, SIPRI.org, where Robert Kelly, for the umpteenth time, has completely debunked the existence in any time of this Parchin explosives testing chamber, which couldn't be used for testing nuclear warheads anyway. The whole thing is bogus and stupid and is already a debunked lie from the very beginning. But anyway, Robert Kelly, former chief IAEA weapons inspector, the missing large explosion chamber at Parchin. It's at SIPRI.org. Just put in SIPRI.org and Robert Kelly, and it'll come right up for you. He's got two or three there on the subject. And I'm over time. I got to get Phil Weiss on the line. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday, and The Future of Freedom with FFF Founder and President Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. And on the line, I got Philip Weiss from the Mondo Weiss blog. And boy, I almost screwed that up. I'm looking at Jeffrey Goldberg's big ugly mug, and I almost said his name out loud. That would be something else. Hey, welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Phil?
Great. How you doing?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us the show today. Sorry about the technical difficulties, is making things a little disjointed around here, but it should be all right. Phil Weiss, he keeps MondoWeiss.net. He's got a great stable of writers over there. The title is The War of Ideas in the Middle East. And so it's, news and politics, focused obviously on, Israel, Palestine, and the Israel lobby in the United States as well. And, all this kind of stuff. I do hope you'll sign up for their morning email and just keep track of what's going on.
Thanks,
at Mondo Weiss. It's really great stuff, man. It really is. I absolutely rely on you. And so now this one goes back. I got quite a few articles here by, I want to go over as many of them as I can, but, I want to start a couple of weeks ago with this one here, October 18th. Goldberg, that is Jeffrey Goldberg at The Atlantic, says the root of the conflict is the Palestinians' anti-Jewish narrative. So, first of all, for those not familiar, could you catch us up? Who is Jeffrey Goldberg, and why is he important?
Jeffrey Goldberg is the most important journalist for the Israel lobby in the United States. He is a very successful and witty writer and media figure. He found anti-Semitism to be so strong in the United States that he moved to Israel in the 1980s and joined their army, and ultimately came back here because he found that society a little too provincial, I think, and closed. And he wanted to have a big career, which he's having here. But he acts as Israel's mouthpiece in this country. He just always stands up for Israel. And this thing is an article that's horse manure. It says that the root cause of the conflict is that Palestinians don't accept the ancient connection of Jews to the land of Israel, the biblical connection. That's why they'll never accept Jews' connection. Well, these people are, you have people living under occupation. That's the problem. People living under military occupation have no rights. 5 million people. That is a problem.
Yeah. All right. Well, a couple of things there. First of all, and obviously we're going to talk about the occupation, but just in religious terms, Muslims know that it was the Jews who first, obviously didn't invent, but identified the one God that they believe in, too, the very same God of Abraham and Moses. And they respect Jesus as a prophet, if not the Savior. And they're another breakoff of Judaism, just like Christianity is. And who in the world would deny that? Find me the most bin Ladenite lunatic imam on this planet to deny the history of the invention of monotheism. And that's their story, too.
Right, but I mean, Scott, that is a very rational and intellectual assertion on your part. I accept it, but there is some concern that this conflict has this religious component, and some of the hatred is infused with religion on both sides. You know?
Oh, sure. I mean, I wouldn't deny that. I'm just saying Jeffrey Goldberg's premise here is just, it doesn't even stand up on the face of it, it doesn't seem like to me.
No,
if Muslims believe in Islam, then they believe in the same God that the Jews believe in.
Yeah, and I mean, let's just be clear here. The father of Zionism was Theodor Herzl. And when he was trying to start a Jewish state 100 years ago, long before the Jewish state was actually started, 50 years before, he always promised everybody, from the Tsar to the Pope to the Sultan, we will internationalize Jerusalem. We will not control Jerusalem and the holy places. That's a recipe for endless war. And FDR recognized that in 1940s when they were saying they wanted a Jewish state that would control Jerusalem. He was saying, you know, you're trying to start a jihad. So, of course, it's going to create, you know, you can't have Israel having sovereignty over the old city of Jerusalem. It's just not fair. It's not going to work out. And by the way, it didn't work out that well when when Jordan had sovereignty over it. So I think it has to be internationalized.
Well, and this gets back to the actual conflict on the ground here, which, never mind the actual Jewishness of the Jewish Israelis there, the humanity of them and the state that they have created there is, never mind being a fait accompli, it's actually already been recognized as legitimate within the 67 borders by the Palestinian Authority and even by Hamas. Is that not correct?
Absolutely. I mean, consider, here are these Palestinians who 67 years ago, they were promised a state. And within a year, the Israelis, they got their state, and the Palestinians have been waiting 7-8 decades, no state. And then 30 years ago, the Palestinians said, okay, we give up our revolutionary struggle. We're not going to try to remove Israel from the map. We are going to accept Israel's existence on nearly four-fifths of the land, and we will take a state on the fragment that's left over. And Israel, rather than pocketing that generous offer in 1988, has continued to colonize the land. Israel has destroyed the two-state solution, and that is what we are seeing now in all the violence. We are seeing a young generation that has no rights and that and is subject to settler violence, and they are responding in this impulsive and violent and awful manner, but they have no rights.
Mm. All right, now, so I have a hard time taking anything Jeffrey Goldberg says seriously or even honestly from his point of view kind of thing. However, this is a very familiar trope. I guess it doesn't really matter whether Goldberg himself believes his own BS on this, but it seems like this is really the widespread belief in Israel. They hate us because we're free. They hate us because we're Jews. They hate us because we're good. And never mind the occupation at all. It is the anti-Semitism that is born into everyone who is not a Semite, and never mind the fact that they are Semites.
Right. And it's sort of like, you know, how do conflicts end? Conflicts end with political solutions, and there's got to be a political solution of this one that addresses Palestinian concerns. And it's not that they're trying to extirpate Jews from the land of Israel or Palestine. I mean, they are Muslims will point out that they lived, as you observed, they lived for thousands of, for over a thousand years with Jews largely peaceably throughout the Middle East. Now, in some of those cases, Jews were second-class citizens, yes, or they had a different status in Muslim societies. But they had they did better in those societies, Jews, by and large, than they did in Christian societies at the same time.
And they protected the Jews from the Christians during those times.
I have a sense that that's the case. I'm not. Yeah, I haven't done the.
The Crusades and during the Inquisition in Spain, when all the Jews were getting kicked out of Spain, where'd they go? They fled to the Middle East,
right?
To be safe,
right. Right. I mean, look, history has been unsafe for a lot of peoples, including Jews. My people have had a long history of persecution, but they've also had a lot of success, Jews. And you can't just look at everything in terms of your victimization, which is what Jeffrey Goldberg does, one of the most powerful. He's a guy who sits down with Netanyahu and with Obama. He has more access than just about any journalist I know because he can address the American Jewish organizations, the Israel lobby. That gives him a lot of power. And this is an era of Jewish power. And I think that part of the responsibility that we have, Americans and Jews, is to recognize this and to get over some of this this claim that is at the basis of Zionism that. The West is unsafe to Jews.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, and that's a whole other topic. In fact, let's take this break here. You and I can't hear it, but we should be able to hear the music playing.
Cool.
We'll go out to this break, and then that's a good point to get back to on the other side of this break. It's the great Philip Weiss, y'all, from MondoWeiss.net. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. And I'm talking with Phil Weiss from MondoWeiss.net, the War of Ideas in the Middle East, MondoWeiss.net. Bunch of great writers there, including Phil, of course. And
thanks, man.
Yeah, well, nah, you deserve it. So anyway, the thing is, we're talking about the reality and perception of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And then right there at the break, you were saying something about how the Israeli government would have diaspora Jews believe that they're not safe in the West and that they got to come to Israel.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually one of the things that Netanyahu says all the time is that the West is not safe. He went to the French Jews and said, move to Israel. So this is the Zionist ideology, and it's completely out of whack with, modern Jewish experience in the United States. And, I don't want to go too a parochial on you here, but this is a Jewish problem. And part of it involves the fact when I first went to Israel, I was 50. I didn't get inoculated with Zionism until never got it, the inoculation. I only went over there after the Iraq war because I knew that it was part of the American problem. But my Jewish friend over there, a friend of my family, said, you know, we who moved to Israel made Aliyah. That means we went higher. And you live in the diaspora, and we call that Yored, which is lower. So they assign a higher spiritual place inside the Jewish community to people who move to Israel. And that kind of, it's a very dangerous form of thinking. And I think it actually is something that a lot of American Jews unconsciously subscribe to. Oh, they're over there. They're on the front line. We can't question them. And they're spiritually superior to us. In fact, they're living in a fascistic society that's completely racist. And where they're shooting down Palestinian kids who have no rights because these kids are flipping out and pulling knives.
Well, yeah, and let's get back to that in just a second. But even on the point of you know, Americans, whether, I guess, you know, your focus always is on, you know, the American Jewish establishment. Down here in Texas, there's a lot of, you know, Cornerstone Church types who are just as Zionist and who vote Republican as hell. And for that reason, probably above very many. But if they love Israel so much, they ought to get in touch with reality a little bit and look at just how destructive this thing is. Because it seems like, you know, either the whole thing is just going to come apart under the world being unwilling to tolerate minority rule under martial law like this forever, or they're going to go full fascism, rename the place Judea, and kill every last Palestinian or drive them into the Jordan River, something like that. Some kind of, you know, complete calamity that would completely destroy what they think of as the Israel they're trying to protect. And if they think that, oh, we have to support them because we love them so much, they're crazy. They need to, if they love them so much, they need to tell them to knock it off. This is murder-suicide here.
Right. Take away the keys to the car. I mean, look, I do think we're facing a crisis at last and inevitably, which is that this society that they have, Israeli Jews have created, is completely inconsistent with Western values. And American Jews are finally waking up to this because some of the good people in Israel are reaching out and saying, please help save us. And save us on whatever terms, some of them are saying. We don't care how you help save us. Give everybody, give everybody the right to vote. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine that American Jews who have led so many important movements for, or been part of so many important movements for freedom and civil rights in the United States, they, by and large, their organizations are supporting a society in which half the people on a racial basis cannot vote for the society, for the government that controls their lives.
Yeah.
It's Jim Crow and worse, and American Jewish organizations have signed off on it. And now the crisis is happening. The awakening is taking place because that society is really going down the tube right now.
And you know
now.
What, man? That's such a great way to frame it, too. Voting rights, civil rights, the right to participate in representative government. That is, no offense or whatever, but that is always, seems to me, a kind of higher principle than liberty to liberals.
Yeah.
And so, okay, good. That is the best way, really, to appeal to them. That on their very, you know, civil right, the right to participate in the government kind of a basis. Never mind, you know, because if you complain about Palestinian property rights, they go, oh, property rights. Well, damn, we're talking about people having their land stolen from them, right? But no, well,
right.
You can't really own land or what, you know. But if you appeal to them on voting rights, I think now you're talking, you know, hey, what about segregated buses and segregated roads and all this kinds of things? These are, now you're speaking the language of the civil rights liberals.
Right.
Jewish
and,
or otherwise.
And it's going to take a long time to break in on the American consciousness. It will take a real long time. I mean, last summer, Jewish settlers, illegal Jewish settlers in the West Bank, burned a Palestinian family to death in an arson attack, completely innocent family in a small village. Three members of the family were killed, and all the liberal Zionist organizations in the United States said, they have gone too far, the settlers, there must be accountability. There's been no accountability. The defense minister said, we know who did it. They haven't charged anybody. So there's been complete impunity for this attack, this gruesome attack, worse than, you know, similar to like the Philadelphia, Mississippi attack during the civil rights era here. No accountability. And the Jewish organization, the liberal Zionist Jewish organizations have let the case drop. because they can't. It goes so much against their dream that Israel is this fair society. It's not. It's worse than Jim Crow. It's worse than apartheid. And three people are burned to death in the most grisly manner, and there is zero accountability. And that's why the Palestinians on the West Bank, the young Palestinians, are so desperate and so afraid. And have seen, you know, generation after generation, they were told they would get a state. They've not gotten any rights at all. And yeah, they're pulling knives. It's terrible. It's awful. I think it's horrible what they're doing. And yet, it's an inevitable result of this oppression.
Mm. All right. So talk about, it seems like beyond the horrible attack on this family and other recent incidents, it was really, and there have been quite a few. I couldn't really name all off of the top of my head because there's too many, but the one that was, that really had a lot of photographs that really made the news was the soldier with the 7-year-old boy or 10-year-old boy or something in the headlock and fighting, and the women fighting him off and protecting the little boy.
Yeah.
This
that
kind of thing.
Else.
But what really, apparently, best I can tell, really set this off was the change of status of who's allowed to do what at the so-called Temple Mount or the Dome of the Rock or the Al-Aqsa Mosque or whatever all you call that place. So can you explain what changed and why it is that that in particular is such a big deal to the Palestinians? Because apparently it has provoked a leaderless kind of, you know, knife intifada here.
Yes, I think that, I mean, it's if you're not a religious person, and I'm not a religious person in a conventional sense, it's hard to make all this out, but, you know, This site in the old city of Jerusalem is revered by Muslims, and it's revered by Jews. But the Muslims have a mosque and the Dome of the Rock on this plateau in the old city. And it's always been a Muslim place of worship. And now Jews are trying to go up. They say this is where the temple, the ancient temple was that was destroyed in the 2nd century A.D., and the earlier one was destroyed a couple hundred years before that. And they want to go up there and pray, too. They're not allowed to pray up there, Jews. And yet there have been indications in the last few months that the status is changing. And when Palestinians hear that the status of a Muslim place is changing, they think of Hebron, where they used to have sole control of the Ibrahimi Mosque, and suddenly the place was divided, and Jews were allowed to worship there all the time in Hebron, and Hebron was colonized by Jews, and Muslims, Palestinians were forced out of their houses. A similar apprehension has arisen among Muslims in Jerusalem and around that their most holy place in that part of the world, the third most holy Muslim site in the world, is because it's under Jewish control, the rules are going to be changed. And Netanyahu took a long time to say, no, we're not changing the rules. He did so. He did not come out and say and shut down this talk because members of his own government want to change the rules. There are right-wing religious members of his government that want more Jewish access to the Al-Aqsa compound, the Temple Mount, that plateau. And they are agitating for more Jewish access. And some of them, there's even his minister of agriculture has even been on a video showing the removal of the Dome of the Rock to make way for the rebuilding of a third temple. So there are religious crazies, obviously, on both sides of this issue generally. But on this case, you have one society that is controlling the space politically, geographically. That's Israel. And some of their leading government figures are agitating for a change in status, and Muslims are freaking out about it.
Well, pretty simple explanation if you ask me. I'm sorry we're out of time for this interview.
Oh, sorry if I rambled.
No, not at all. It's just that I got to go and we got to go.
Great.
But it's always great to talk to you. I hope that I can get you back on the show. And thank you for keeping all your great writers, Adam and Charlotte
it.
And everybody. They're just great and,
cool.
And really appreciate you, Phil.
Thanks, Matt. Okay, talk to you soon.
All right, see ya. All right, you guys, that was the great Phil Weiss. He's at MondoWeiss.net, the War of Ideas in the Middle East. And that's it for today's show. Thanks. See ya.